Let's open in a word of prayer. Lord, indeed, we do look forward to that day in which we will be in your presence and behold your face. And just pray, Lord, as we look into your word here tonight, that you would grant us wisdom, grant us understanding, as we see one of the great conspiracies that has ever been upon the earth, the conspiracy of Absalom, Lord. I pray, Lord, that you would grant us wisdom, give us the mind of wisdom. May we be discerning as a result of this study. In Christ's name, we pray, amen. Okay, the conspiracy of Absalom. We're looking at verses 1 through 12 of chapter 15 tonight. And just by way of review, you might remember at this point in David's life, he's approximately 57 years old, give or take a year or two. Can't be much more than that. But Absalom is approximately 27. We're looking at, by the end of these verses, he's going to be in his early 60s. And Absalom in his early 30s. At this point, David has been manipulated by Joab and then by Absalom secondarily to receive Absalom back and be reconciled to him without his repentance. This immediately comes back to haunt David as he is, within 4 years, is confronted with an insurrection that is propagated by Absalom. We have already read about his charming good looks at the end of chapter 14. Now in all Israel was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised. So again, this is already his reputation. People are already saying this about him prior to this point. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. And of course, his beautiful flowing locks was his most distinguishing factor there. But as we see tonight, in the past, we've kind of been tempted to look at Absalom as the young man full of chivalry, avenging his sister's honor, right? Murdering Amnon to avenge her. And we can tend to be a little sympathetic towards him. And yet, as we go on here, we see that he is a good for nothing. Okay, he is a violent person. He's a murderer. And he is, in his own right, a sexually immoral person. And so that sympathetic view that we might be tempted to have of him goes away after this. And as far as we see this unfold here, this conspiracy here, he is a true demagogue. Okay, that's a term. That's our term of the week here. Demagogue. A political leader who gains power by arousing people's emotions and prejudices. One who advances his own interests by affecting a deep devotion to the interests of the people. Okay, this is all pretenses. But he shows himself to be someone who is very good at being sympathetic. Ends up turning the people's hearts against David and playing upon, their emotions. Again, he already has that look to him, and now he reaches into their hearts, as we'll see here tonight. Any questions or thoughts before we get into the conspiracy of Absalom? Okay, who would like to read for us verses 1 through 6? Yes, Vince.
1 through 6.
1 through 6. Okay, thank you. A chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. What is this all about? Okay, yeah, he wants to look the part. If you put on a regal facade, then very naturally people will start to think of you as the king, okay? And that's what he wants to do. He wants to project this image. This is a bunch of pomp. This is showmanship, okay? This is a man who wants to be king. And, you know, what was he thinking at this time? Was he thinking that maybe he didn't have a real chance at this point? His father would never make him king? Was he thinking that perhaps he was just not patient enough to wait until he became king? He wanted to get there faster. We don't know. But he launches into this endeavor because, again, he wants to be king sooner than he thinks he will be. And he turns to the people. Okay, he ignores David. He doesn't go that route. He doesn't try to, you know, grovel in David's presence and somehow ingratiate himself to the king that way. No, he turns to the people. And fundamentally, there's two basic ways that we've seen. Absalom represents one, and David really represents the other. There's two basic ways that we see that people can garner influence or support by the people, okay? One is what we might call the path of accomplishment, and the other one is showmanship, okay? And as we think about this, think about influence through accomplishment, and I'm just throwing this out there as far as, you know, trying to define this my own definition. Accomplishment is about proving character and demonstrating ability through genuine, challenging, meaningful experiences. Have we seen this before? When have we seen someone demonstrate, proving their character and demonstrating ability? Okay, Uriah is an instance. Briefly. What? Okay. Yeah, we saw this in the life of David for sure. It happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine, this is Goliath, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s." So here's an instance where he distinguishes himself through accomplishment, and therefore the people, okay, he has influence among the people. And so much so that Saul is troubled by this, right? This is the legitimate way to gain influence, by the way, is through demonstrating character and ability through accomplishment. Now, David was in his late teens when this transpired. Okay, he was in his late teens. Absalom, approximately 27 at this point, and it would seem that ship has sailed. Okay, that ship has sailed. There's no getting that decade back. So he could potentially have distinguished himself through accomplishment, okay, but he sees a much shorter route, the shorter route of showmanship. Okay, he could have potentially pursued a route of accomplishment, but he really lacked the faith and character to accomplish what David had. Okay, he is not that person. He is not the man who would have faced Goliath with faith. Yes. Right. Yes. We don't really hear of any kind of accomplishment. He just seems to be hanging around Jerusalem the whole time. And for sure, the next 4 years, that's exactly what he's doing. What he ends up executing here. And perhaps, I mean, nothing stated this way, but he does have to ask permission to leave. He asked permission of David to leave. So perhaps he was still under city arrest, not house arrest, but city arrest. Okay, so here we see he's not a man of faith, he's not a man of character, he's not a man of ability at this point. So he turns to showmanship. And we think about showmanship. Showmanship is about surrounding yourself with an aura of accomplishment. Okay, it's all about projecting an image, all right? And that's what he does. An aura of accomplishment, having never had any real meaningful experiences and thus manifesting poor character. And that's what we see Absalom engaging in here. As I thought about this a little bit, I thought it would be good to put up some examples here for comparison, just to get you maybe thinking about how this has happened in modern times. We can look at these individuals here. This fellow on the left, his name is, what is his name? Roger Day, 2010 in England. This picture was snapped of him. Very impressive items on his chest. If you were the guy standing behind him, you'd feel pretty inferior, wouldn't you? You'd say, could you stand, get the guy behind you to stand in front of you to be directly behind this guy. But he was shown that after all this was, spread around the internet or whatever, people looked at that and said, there's no way that this is true, and searched it out and found out that it wasn't true. In fact, it turned out his only military experience consisted of him doing 18 months with a junior leadership regiment. So he never even served in the British military. Now, contrast the guy on the right. Sir Adrian Carton de Wyart served in the British Army for 60 years fighting in the Boer War, or Boer, I don't know, South Africa, World War I and World War II. Interesting story about this guy. He was 60 years old when the plane he was riding in was shot down off the coast of Italy. He had to swim to shore, spent 2 years in a prisoner of war camp, escaped for 8 days. And, of course, he was captured because he didn't speak Italian. So, but here's this guy right here. He's the real deal, right? Kind of looks like it, too, doesn't he? Yeah, he has a little different kind of merits on him. Missing an arm, missing an eye, and so forth. But you see how this is effective here. It looks very impressive. By the way, the reason he did that was to capture his wife. She was like 24 years younger than she was. She used all these false medals to impress her, and that's how he got his wife. But do we know these guys? Who's this guy? Oh, no, nobody knows who that is. Yeah, that's Idi Amin. He was the tyrant of Uganda. Who is this guy? Okay, yeah, Gaddafi. Boy, look at those medals. Look at all that valor on their chest, right? A lot of showmanship there. Anybody know who this guy is? You could almost make it out on his name right there. Basil Plumley. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Okay, I believe he's the only person who fought in all three, had combat experience in both World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Okay, so that's Basil Plumley, enlisted men. And, here we see, the nice flashy and then the substance. Okay, you can't really tell by the outside, can you? And so showmanship versus genuine accomplishment. Now, as we think about this, influenced by accomplishment, accomplishment is about proving character and demonstrating ability through genuine, challenging, meaningful experiences. Now, can you accomplish something without character? Okay, yeah. We could look at some of David's fellow military men that he had been with him from the beginning, who don't have a lot of character. One in particular sticks out. Who? Joab. Yeah, Joab accomplished. Boy, Joab was the hero of Jerusalem. Remember, he's the one who crawled in and opened the gate so they could all go in and take Jerusalem. Became the head of the army, the official head of the army at that time. We also see here that Absalom experiences a degree of success. Okay, he comes that close to accomplishing his goal. And yet, the only reason he doesn't succeed is because of an intervention by the Lord that we read about. So you don't have to necessarily have character to accomplish much. And so, again, this is about proving character, proving ability. And of course, ability without character, you just have Joab. And that's not, doesn't make for a very good king either. Okay. Now, why did David allow this ostentation by Absalom? The chariots, the chariot, the horse, the runners. Why did he allow it? Public opinion? He didn't want to cross the people? Okay. Okay. Maybe. Okay. Anyone else? Okay, yeah, maybe he's distracted. I mean, maybe he's worried about kingdom matters and he's just like, oh yeah, Absalom. He's just not giving much thought to that, not really paying attention. He figures everything's good. He's around town. I can keep an eye on him. Perhaps he didn't think that Absalom would honestly try to supplant him. You know, just that thought never entered his mind that he, this big show and this production would actually succeed with people, that it would actually, that he would come so close to supplanting him as the king. And it goes to show you, never underestimate things. You sit there and say, but that's just, don't people see through that? Isn't that just a big show? Can't people see this? Boy, be careful, because they didn't see through Absalom. They were swayed by this. I also see here that he has a general weakness when it comes to standing against his children. Pure and simple. We see this later when the same exact thing unfolds with Adonijah. Now Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself saying, I will be king. So he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen with 50 men to run before him. Wonder where he got that idea. His father had never crossed him at any time by asking, why have you done so? This is in the wake of Absalom, mind you. So he already knows the end of this road, potentially. And he was also a very handsome man, and he was born after Absalom. Never crossed him. Just seems to be kind of in David's DNA here. He has a hard time correcting his children. Okay, well, let's read further here about Absalom. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. The gate was the place of official business. This is the gate of Jerusalem. So this was not only city business that was transacted here, but it was also the way, the gateway, if you will, to the king. So kingdom business was carried out here as well. Most likely, it was where you would go. If you had a court case, you would probably speak to someone at the gate. You'd get put on the docket, and then, you know, that would be communicated to the court of the king. And when court was in session, you know, when your turn came up, you would be able to go. So we see here with Absalom, he is strategic, okay? He rises early, right? And he catches men before they can even get to the docket, before they can even get to the person that to talk to someone to in connection with the king here. He's the first face they see when they're coming with their case. And it says, and when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? And he would say, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel. We must ask in this, what is being indicated here? The reason is because when it says the one of the tribes of Israel, we have a tendency to think in terms of the 12 tribes, okay? And there is that use of Israel in the Bible, you know, especially when you go back to, you know, Joshua or Judges. That would be the consistent usage to refer to all 12 tribes. But that's not the usage that we see in 1 and 2 Samuel. This is really referring to the 10 northern tribes, okay? And let me just show you this real quick. This is in 1 Samuel 18:16. It says, but all Israel and Judah loved David. And he went out and came in before them. Again, we need to remember that it's how the author uses the terms that need to determine the meaning for us. And this was most likely written after the divided kingdom. So we're in the reign of Rehoboam, and the book of books of First and Second Samuel are written here. This is in 2 Samuel 5:5. At Hebron, David reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 30 years over all Israel. But the men of Israel answered. Now this is afterwards, and this is important too, because this is still the same instance here, still the same story, if you will. But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king. Now that's kind of interesting because it says 10 parts. How many tribes were there? Okay, so who's being called by Judah? Judah, yeah, most likely Benjamin. Judah and Benjamin are being called by Judah, even at this point. So even then, there was in Jerusalem, you might remember, is in Benjamin. Okay, so that was kind of David's political move to unite the kingdom here, to put his capital in Benjamin And of course, he was of the tribe of Judah. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back our king? This is after Absalom is defeated. Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. We have that same language, the men of Israel. In our present passage, we also have all Israel, just as we saw previously. Those phrases indicate those 10 tribes. So he's being highly selective here about who he talks to. So he is singling out these 10 tribes, the tribes of Israel, the 10 tribes of Israel in the north. He's singling them out for this specific manipulation. Okay, this specific manipulation. But we could ask, what about Judah? You know, did he consider Judah as already in the bag? Maybe since they were blood, you know, they would naturally just follow him once David was ousted. It is interesting how he brings his plan to action. All of it transpires in this little region right here. Here's Mahanaim. That's where David ends up fleeing to. Absalom starts out down here in the south, in Hebron. And what he actually does, all the tribes that he's influencing right now are up here in the north. Okay, they're all in the north. Benjamin is right here in the middle. Judah's down in the south. All the other 10 tribes are up here. So he actually starts his little invasion from Hebron here. He enters into Jerusalem from the south and he pushes David to the north. I think he hoped to trap him. Okay, between all those tribes that he had influenced, he's coming from the south. And presumably, once David is out of Jerusalem and Absalom's firmly established there, then he just assumed Judah would follow him. And that's what they do. I mean, he read it right. They did follow him, even though he was not putting this tactic into practice. Perhaps he was afraid the men of Judah, word would get back to David. Who knows? But he's singling out the 10 tribes here. Well, what is he singling them out with? It says, then Absalom would say to him, see, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king. What is he engaging in? Okay, favoritism. Okay, discrimination against David. Oh, okay. Right, yes. And he flatters too. He says, look, your claims are good. Everybody wants to hear that they're right. You start telling people that they're right, they're going to be your friend, right? They're going to think you're the best, especially if they stand before David later and he says, oh, I don't see your case. Okay, that's really going to sour them. Now, the question becomes, was David unavailable? You know, what was it? Was he alluding to the reality that perhaps David was unavailable? Some suggest that he was ill at this time. There's two key psalms in this discussion that were written that refer to this time, and that's Psalm 41 and Psalm 55. And in one of those psalms, we read this, the Lord will sustain him upon his sickbed. In his illness, you restore him to health. David could very well have been ill during this time. Again, as indicated here, there's no clear statement to that effect in the text here. Perhaps this was just the normal backlog of the court system. I mean, we know what that's like, right? It's ridiculous how long it takes to get to court once you actually have your case, you know, put on the docket and so forth. And so this might just be that normal insurmountable backlog. What do the words, but no man listens to you on the part of the king, imply? Okay. Yeah, the king is kind of aloof, uninterested in the common man, uninterested in his plight, right? We hear this rhetoric today. Yeah, you know, you got the lofty official over here out of touch with reality. It's an easy way to paint somebody. Right? They're off in, you know, far away Jerusalem, sitting in their ivory tower, out of touch with you. You come in your plight, and there's a willful neglect on his part. Truth be told, being king is a very busy job. I mean, just that's the reality of it. And if he's supposed to adjudicate these cases at the same time, boy, he's maybe just squeezing in a handful a day or, you know, able to dedicate only so much time. But the implication is that David is a selfish, self-serving king. Power has made him lose touch. Now, what I see here, what in reality this whole thing testifies to, or what this practice, I should say, of what Absalom is saying testifies to, is Absalom's lack of any genuine responsibility. This man has a lot of time on his hands, right? He's able to get up bright and early every morning, go out here and sway the people in this way. He needed something to do. That would have been wise on David's part.
Mm-hmm. And then also the
victim card toward the end, like, and your king doesn't. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Make him feel like a victim. I'm your true advocate.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good observation. Thank you. Well, he continues on. He says, moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or case would come to me and I would give him justice. What is this subtly implying about David? Okay, he doesn't care, and he's unjust. Yeah, Absalom's the righteous one, David's the wicked one. Okay, I'm just, my father is not. Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. In other words, I should be king. Now, he's smart about it. He doesn't say that exact statement. That would be treason, okay? So he's subtle about it. Instead, he's just, you know, someone, I mean, it's just kind of like wishful thinking. But he's sowing those thoughts in people's minds so that when the day actually comes where they hear Absalom is king, they're ready to embrace it, okay? So he's sowing these subtle thoughts that will bloom later. And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. What message would this convey to these individuals who were coming to him? That's right, he's one of us. I feel your pain. Don't treat me that way. I'm just like you are, right? This is the kissing babies, you know, kind of thing. And of course, probably no other passage illustrates better the proverb 27:6, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Here is a man who really looks at these people as useful idiots. You know, he's smarter than all of them. Nobody knows what he's doing. And look at how easily I can manipulate them. And lo and behold, he is the kiss of an enemy. Now, If the individual did make it into the presence of David, they have now been groomed to be offended by David. Because when they walked into the presence of David, what happened? Yeah, they prostrated themselves, and David just stayed on his throne. He didn't get up. So immediately, they're in their mind contrasting, well, you know, Absalom was just out there. He's so humble. You know, if he was king in the land, I know what kind of greeting I would get. I would come here and he'd just lift me up and he would have me sit on his lap and whisper into his ear my case. And we would just, you know, that's what he's doing here. He's grooming them. He's treating them like family. David, you know, he's, you know, keeping us down. Well, in this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. Now, you might recall, I think I had this up there earlier, but it's a good reminder here, but all Israel and Judah loved David, right? Way back, they loved David, but that is no longer the case. Absalom is now finding his way into their hearts. Again, this shows how superficial the people's loyalty to God's choice really was, okay? They're presented with this, you know, sycophant, who is, he's of beautiful appearance, and he's coming and just ingratiating himself to them, and they fall for it. Any questions or thoughts before we move on? Yes?
Yes, on a different kind of subject, but I thought that this example here, you know, the interaction between Absalom and David and Adonijah, mm-hmm. It's a good illustration of the dynamics of God's sovereignty.
Sure. God's going to take care of it. Sure. Yeah, that could have been one way you put it together.
It looks like from the example we have Elijah, he said, you know, his father never crossed him. So that seems to me that there was an expectation that maybe he should have said something.
Right. Yeah. I would see that too here. Yeah. And, you know, again, applying that situation to here. Yeah, that commentary there. Anyone else? Okay. Who would like to read verses 7 through 9 for us? Anyone? Yes, Kurt.
At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord of Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow, though I lived at Eshur and Aram, saying, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord." The king said to him, "Go in peace." So he arose and went to Hebron.
Okay, thank you. Verse 7, 40 years, probably actually should be 4 years. It's most likely a scribal error. There's no significant event that would mark off 40 years here. It doesn't correspond with David's beginning of his reign or anything really. The birth of Absalom, none of that. There's no significant event here. As with many instances that we've seen in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, the numbers somehow got, you know, confused along the way. And we've seen that in other places in the books. Again, just scribal errors here. Again, better to regard it as 4 years. So this puts Absalom at approximately 31 years of age. And the fact that he went out and did this for 4 years, what does that tell us about Absalom? Yes, he did not have genuine responsibility. Anyone else? He is determined. This is kind of going back. We've seen this with him before, even when he's a young man. How long did he wait to kill Amnon? 2 full years. This is a patient man. And in a certain context, used in the right way, channeled in the right way, these are good qualities, right? He's patient, he's diligent, he perseveres, right? He had some positive qualities here, but he's not using them properly. We've seen this before. Jonadab was this way. Now, was this vow Absalom refers to here, would this really have been uttered by Absalom and Geshur? What's the vow there? Okay. Does that sound like something Absalom would say? Yeah. How can we conclude that this was, just a bold-faced lie? Other than the fact that the whole thing's, you know, obviously a conspiracy. But, you know, think back on what we've seen previously. Okay. Yeah. He made no attempt to reconcile with his father. He wasn't missing Jerusalem all that much. Okay. He wasn't missing Jerusalem all that once. And once he arrived, remember what he said? Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent you saying, come in that I may send you to the king to say, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to still be there." I mean, he's not enjoying it back in Jerusalem. His heart wasn't there. He wasn't longing to be in the city of God. This was the furthest thing from his mind. He says, "For your servant vowed a vow while he was living in Geshur in Aram, saying, if the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord." On the surface, what might this appear to be? I made a vow. I want to fulfill that vow. I made a vow to serve the Lord. Think about David. Think about what he's been longing for Absalom. Yeah, some repentance, some spirituality here, that he's got a relationship with God, right? And now it's coming out of his mouth. You could see where maybe David's longing here is still getting the best of him. This is exactly what he wants to hear, at least. We know that. He's telling him what he wants to hear. Shows that Absalom knew what he wanted to hear, too, to manipulate him. But here it is, 9 years after he's killed Amnon. Right? 9 years has transpired here. And now he says, "Oh, I want to serve the Lord." In addition to his lying, what other sin is he committing here? What's that? Okay, yeah, not honoring his father. He's manipulating his father. Anything else? Blasphemy, yes. He's invoking the name of the Lord now to sell his conspiracy. He's got a plan here, and he's not above using God to sell that plan, to manipulate people. And that's exactly what he engages in here, is using God's name in a vain manner. Well, Hebron, he wants to go to Hebron for obvious reasons. This is a really short trip right here, approximately 20 miles, I think it was. And he transpires his, or he consolidates his clan, his group that he's going to march back into Jerusalem with. And significant here, as we think back on Hebron, what historical significance does Hebron have? Okay, Abraham's buried there. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they're all in the tomb there at the cave of Machpelah. Okay, yes. This is a group of people who've been disenfranchised, right? I mean, they used to be the capital city. And then David moved to Jerusalem. We thought we were going to be special. We were going to be the capital of the United Kingdom, but no. Now, we're just, you know, second to Jerusalem. And again, with no apparent misgivings, David lets him go. Any questions or thoughts there through verse 9? Yes. No, you're fine. Right.
But on the other hand, you know, if David sees what Absalom is doing, and he announces, he says, you know, I'd like to go out of town. You know, if I were there, he said, please, go.
Yeah, that's right. Do something, you know. Exactly. That's a good point. Yeah, that could have been his thinking. It'd definitely be a thought crossing my mind as well. Okay, who would like to read verses 10 through 12? Anyone? Anita? Okay, thank you. In these verses, we see just how brilliant Absalom is. This is not about just these one-on-one, you know, winning their hearts at this point. He has done something that is so brilliant that you can't help but see it as demonic, okay? He has managed to bring a bunch of people together. He's been manipulating a whole host of people. They have no idea what's about to transpire. The only people, I mean, he just has a very small group of people, these spies, if you will, that are going to go and sneak in, and they're going to say, Absalom is king! Okay, that's the only group that knows what's about to happen. And all these other people have all been groomed and conditioned to embrace that reality. And he succeeds. It's amazing. A key element to a successful conspiracy here. Oh, wait. Let's talk about the steps that he takes here. We've already seen one of the steps. He inclines the hearts of the people toward himself, and away from David. Okay? That will be repeated, by the way, because I just kept copying it for the next slides. Anyway, so he's already done the hard work. I mean, he's done the really hard part. 4 years of laboring in the trenches, right? Getting up early so that he could go and do this and manipulate these people to groom and condition them for this moment. Then we see the sounding of the trumpet, which is a very regal reality. It would have signaled a very important message. There was a communication that was circulating. Something was happening somewhere. What was it? Okay, that's what the sound of the trumpet would have signaled for these individuals, for the nation. And step number 3, we see that they circulate a confusing proclamation. Absalom is king in Hebron. Now, what's interesting about this statement is just as significant as what it says is what it does not say. What does it not say? Okay. What about David? Yeah, if you're the populace out here and you hear Absalom's king in Jerusalem or in Hebron, what happened to David? Did he die? Now, remember, you just didn't pick up the phone in that day. You didn't just call to have, you know, you didn't get on Snopes and fact check or anything like that, right? You just heard this word being spread around by some guy running through the streets. Absalom is king in Hebron. Absalom is king in Hebron. And you can't check it out. And all this confusion that is now ensuing, there's only one consistent narrative, one consistent message, and that is Absalom is king. So you might, well, David must be dead. Something must have happened. But Absalom's king, right? And so a key element of a successful conspiracy is to keep people confused, keep them guessing, and make your narrative the only sure word in their lives. That's what he's doing here. The proclamation leaves the hearer with only one option, accept Absalom as king. And again, a whole host of people are already predisposed to this reality at this point. They're already predisposed to accepting this. Well, step four, lure away 200 of the key residents of Jerusalem, isolate them at the different disenfranchised former capital, Hebron, coerce them. This would have been a context. You got to remember, they're from Jerusalem. They're down in Hebron now. This isn't their town, okay? Hebron is the disenfranchised former capital, and they are now all of a sudden pressured into supporting you. And then you have this grand procession back to Jerusalem. Right? This would have served a couple of purposes. Most likely, I would see here that this would have deprived David of some key individuals in his government. Okay, he was probably very strategic to pick people that David would have been dependent upon in his own government. And then all of a sudden, when he has to flee, he has a whole host of people. It's like, well, where's so-and-so? You know, what happened to this guy? Who's going to mount, you know, this? And if he gets locked in the city, he doesn't have these individuals. And so David all of a sudden finds himself backpedaling without these people he normally depended upon. I also see where they will be key in turning Jerusalem, the populace of Jerusalem, to Absalom. I mean, here these people have come back. And of course, they're coming back looking as supporters. And Jerusalem just welcomes them back and welcomes him back. And what's going to happen here? Momentum. Absalom proves himself to be the master of momentum here. Okay, and number five, recruit David's most valuable and trusted advisor, Ahithophel. Ahithophel. Why would Ahithophel just jump on board with Absalom? Anybody remember? Okay, yeah, he was the grandfather of Bathsheba. He's got a little bit of an axe to grind with David here, doesn't he? He has an axe to grind. And so he just jumps right on board as well. Absalom has read everything. This is like a masterpiece in an evil way. It says, Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city of Gilo, while he was offering the sacrifice. The sacrifices, plural. Again, what sacrifice? Whose sacrifices are in view here? Absalom's or Ahithophel's? The only other time we, you know, read of sacrifices is when they're implied earlier in the text, as far as in connection with a vow. There's no sacrifices mentioned there, but whenever there was a fulfilling of a vow, there would have been sacrifices involved. So most likely this is Absalom's fulfilling of a vow. While he is sacrificing and feeding these 200 guests, he sent for Ahithophel, which would have been just south of Hebron. And then he concludes there in verse 12, the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. You know, this is what I see here. It's hard to stand against a mob. And what he's orchestrating here is confusion. And you've got this, you know, they're only getting one story that Absalom is king. We have no idea what happened to David. Okay. And all of a sudden there's this chant going around. Absalom is king. Absalom is king. You know, that mob mentality is hard to stand alone. And it just snowballs. And the more people that join, the harder it is to stand. And here he is. All the pressure is being put on these individuals in the nation. And he is successfully, again, with very few people knowing it until the very moment that it transpired. Yes. Well, sure.
And that is Joab, right? He's a self-centered man. He sticks with David. Maybe he's got to make it, but there's some hint of loyalty there.
Well, yeah. And you got to remember that Absalom's kind of made the score known with Joab too, right? He burned his field. You know, I'm driving, buddy. So you're right. He's just as selective in who he doesn't call, because I'm sure he had already read everybody. It's just like, okay, I'm never going to go anywhere with the Cherethites or the Pelethites or, you know, the Gittites and, you know, all these, you know, choice men that David had with him. He doesn't even bother with them. Joab, Abishai, he goes for the ones, those 200 men. I mean, they were selected specifically because they would have been easy to manipulate. Probably not military men in the army. Yes? Well, if you were living in Jerusalem, I mean, that city was populated by people, families that were in connection with the government, largely. I mean, before that, it was established solely as the king, you know, the head of the kingdom. So there's all Canaanites before that. And there was still a sizable Canaanite population there as well. Jebusites still in the area, as we'll see later. But, yeah, and maybe that's, you know, maybe they weren't key individuals. They would have been key individuals from the standpoint that they would have been influential. He wouldn't have just invited anybody to, you know, the pauper on the corner gets to go to Absalom, the king's son's party. That wouldn't have been the case. These would have been influential people. And if he was thinking about marching back into Jerusalem, you would want influential people with you who people would respect their opinion and follow them. Yes? Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, he wasn't rounding up all the riffraff and saying, hey, you know, because they wouldn't have had any significance. He's being very shrewd in the way he's executing this. Anyone else? Okay. And the Lord was behind, you know, with David. So, and he intervenes for sure. We have a statement to that effect. And it's really neat how he intervenes. That's probably the most exciting part of the story, is how God intervenes here. It looks like an impossible situation right now. Amen. All right. Who would like to start us out here tonight?